Chapter 29. A Day in the Life of Josef Kolsko. As 6 days passed and Josef's days blurred, with every hour filled by something important, something he needed to do. Sixth hour. Josef woke at 6 a.m. His mind still translated Kielan hours into the timekeeping of his former life. He knew the time because outside a bedroom window was lighter than inside the room, and he heard a single distant ring from a St. Thomas Abbey bell. Clan Kielan recognized 24 hours in a day, and the Kielan Abbeys by custom rang once every hour. Thus, the first sign of approaching daylight and the single ring meant the beginning of sixth hour, 6 a.m., to Josef's brain. It had taken an Anyar year, about 9/10 of an Earth year, for Josef not to reflexively look for a digital clock as his first waking act. He still did it occasionally, though now as an act of remembering what he used to do, instead of unconsciously looking for the clock. Mara's absence in the bed was a further sign of the time. She must have left recently, because when he reached to her side of the bed, the sheet still held a hint of warmth. Her rising might have triggered Josef's arousal. He had semi-consciously noted her getting out of bed two other times during the night and coming back minutes later. Aeneas was a regular feeder, and Josef felt both relieved and half guilty that fathers were not involved in feeding infants. No bottle feeding or breast pumping existed on Anyar. Thus, he was assured of complete sleep most nights, while Mara would take a substantial nap during the day to make up for Aeneas's multiple feedings and changings during the night. Thankfully, although the little bugger was a healthy eater and squawker, he slept solidly through the night, except for the feedings. Josef let himself enjoy the lassitude of the bed for another few minutes before reluctantly throwing off the covers and coming to his feet. It would be a full day. After pulling on pants and a shirt, he padded barefoot to the kitchen. He could smell what passed for bacon in Kielan, and when he came to the kitchen door, he heard peals of laughter. Mara, Anarind, and Miramel. Hearing Mara laugh always lit a small glow in his chest. She had been so serious when he first met her. Anarind had gradually relaxed after coming to them, though Josef still caught melancholy expressions on her face when she thought no one was looking. He swung open the kitchen door, and the merriment subsided at his appearance, though, by the looks on the three women's faces, it was likely due to their not wanting to share the cause of the laughter with a mere male.
"Good morning, Josef," said Mara, smiling.
Anarind only nodded, her face still lit from the laughter. Miramel bobbed her head, the only version of a curtsy she could manage while breastfeeding both Aeneas and her own daughter at the same time. The idea of a woman bare from the waist up and feeding two babies didn't strike the islanders as peculiar.
"I won't ask what was so funny. You might tell me," said Josef, bringing on a burst of giggling.
Only then did he notice Cirrus Clithro, who, like Miramel, had been widowed by the Battle of Moreland City. Cirrus served as cook for the household and was busy frying salted coney meat, a.k.a. bacon, and pulling a pan of biscuits out of the wood-burning stove. Seventh hour.
"All right, Josef, it's time for your writing,"
announced Mara.
"You have a full day planned. It's seventh hour now, and you may not get time later. Remember, you meet with the glassblowers at eighth hour."
New child or not, her own activities or not, Mara continued to keep a schedule for Josef, something she'd started when they married and moved to Abersford. He found it both helpful and annoying. She knew the precise time by the pendulum timepiece hanging on the kitchen wall. Her parents had given her this expensive present years ago, but it ticked too loudly for Josef to want it in the bedroom. Made by skilled craftsmen on Landolin, the closest continent to Cadellium, the clock face showed the 24 hours of an Anyar day,
though the symbols depicted one of the Landolin dialects and not Kadeli. Mera's pendulum clock was indicative of the more sophisticated timepieces he'd seen, although these appeared mainly in abbeys, official sites such as registrar offices and the Keelan clan headquarters, some town and village clock towers, and homes of the more well-to-do Keelanders. The rest of the people kept time by listening to abbey bells, if the listener was close enough to hear, and by consulting various versions of water clocks, hourglasses, and even sundials for the daylight hours. Anya had an advantage in that the axial tilt responsible for differences in seasons was much smaller for Anya than on Earth, leading to less distinct seasons. This resulted in year-round cropping on the farms, though the selection of specific crops varied within the year, and less variation in the length of daylight. A BBC Sword and Sandal series Yosef had watched on TV had mentioned that the Romans used 12 hours each of daylight and night, no matter the season. That led to winter hours of 45 minutes and summer hours of 75 minutes, oddly inefficient for the supposedly practical Romans, Yosef had thought at the time. In contrast, Kadelium had the same relative latitude as Panama, and with the lesser axial tilt, the length of daylight and night hours varied by only a few minutes. The same relative consistency in the sun's position as it crossed the sky in daylight made sundials more reliable than on Earth. As for the average Keelander, farmers and ranchers needed little precise timekeeping, because their lives revolved around sunrise to sunset, while people in towns and villages listened to local bells and used the sun's position in daylight to judge time. Pocket watches were known but expensively imported from Landolin. Despite different methods of keeping time in Keelan, variations occurred in a single system, with the abbeys maintaining consistency across the province. Yosef didn't realize that this was not the norm for other clans, until he began interacting more outside Keelan. Not only did differences exist in when to start counting the 24 hours, there were also differences in the frequency of bell rings, whether hours remained constant or varied with the season, whether a standard applied for the entire province, and whether the clan kept a formal time. All of which led to Yosef's insistence on island-wide standards and the topic of his first session outside the Koskal property on this day. Yosef's daily writing schedule had been reduced because of all of his other commitments, but Mera scheduled it for an hour three times a six-day. Today he picked up where he had left off 2 days previously, in the middle of a chapter titled Carbene Complexes, from a textbook on organometallic chemistry, a subject he remembered thinking interesting at the time he took the course, though in writing down what his memory recalled, he couldn't account for his prior interest. He finished the chapter and had moved on to organometallic reaction mechanisms, when Mera rescued him by reminding him he needed to leave for Kernford and a meeting with workers from a glassblowing shop. Eighth hour. Yosef left the house, mounted Seabiscuit, and neared his destination when he heard St. Tomo's bell ring once. It had taken him 6 minutes to reach the newly developing Kernford Industrial Park, a planned expanded version of his shops in Abersford. He couldn't have been more than 4 minutes past the bell when he walked into the glassblowing shop. There, he met the three workers scheduled to present their latest results in making standardized hourglasses. The project resulted from one of a seemingly endless parade of ideas occurring to Yosef, most of which he now turned over to craftsmen and left it to them to figure out how to make the ideas happen. This especially applied in cases where he had a concept in mind, but his enhanced memory lacked details on that particular subject. In the case of hourglasses, the Kadeli needed mechanisms for fighting units to maintain matching times. There simply weren't enough pocket watches, even the clunkier ones most commonly owned on Kadelium, to outfit more than the leaders of 100 men or more. The only solution he could see was to produce small and accurate enough hourglasses that could be carried by horseback or wagon. He initially worried that time kept by a stationary commander might differ from that of men ordered to ride hard to a destination. Empirical tests proved the differences in times between stationary and moving hourglasses were not significant enough to be a problem. Josef had turned over to the workmen the task of producing two types of hourglasses, one for 1 hour and one for 10 minutes. Any need for coordination would have to rely on multiples of those two times. For example, if two units needed to attack at the same time in 1 hour and 20 minutes, but the units remained out of visual sight and lacked any other coordinating mechanisms, the timing would depend on one flow of a 1 hour hourglass and two of a 10 minute hourglass. Until they had access to more mechanical and portable timepieces, the hourglasses would have to do as stopgaps for daylight hours. Today, Josef would witness the results.
"We quickly gave up trying to blow identical chambers," said the lead worker. "We had no way to control the variation, so any 2 hourglasses would go through a single flow cycle in the same time. We know you said you wanted matching times, which wasn't possible, no matter what we tried. However, we think we came close enough for your purposes. The solution was obvious once it occurred to us. We wouldn't make the chambers identical, so we adjusted the amount of the flowing material for a specific chamber and the size of the channel connecting the upper and lower chambers. Once this occurred to us, it went quickly. We simply made hourglasses with one end open, adjusted the amount of flow material to match the time it took to empty the upper chamber, compared to a pendulum clock standard, then sealed the top reservoir. We found that among the different flow materials commonly used, ground marble, filtered for size, gave the best results." The worker showed Josef two sets of 6 hourglasses, each of the two types about 3 inches tall, with different diameters. The set of more slender hourglasses was fastened to a board, and the worker turned them all over at the same time, starting when the pendulum clock's hand moved to a new marking. They stood watching until all of the ground marble had run out of the 6 upper chambers. The difference in emptying amounted to only a few grains, hardly more than a second, Josef estimated. As the chambers emptied, he looked at the clock just as the hand moved to a marker 10 minutes from the starting point. "As you can see, Sir Kolsko, the 6 function almost identically. We also compared them to one another when some are stationary and others move by wagon or horse. We do see a small difference, but only a matter of 5 or 6 marble grain differences between moving or being stationary."
"Good enough," Josef thought to himself.
"We've done the same testing with the 1 hour hourglasses. It takes longer to get the exact amount of ground marble for each hourglass, but the result is the same. If you have time, we can demonstrate the longer-timed hourglasses."
"Not now," said Josef.
"Send these to Dennis Vega and tell him I suggested he have some men test them many times to be certain of the consistency. Assuming Sir Vega is satisfied, continue production to 100 each of the 2 sizes of hourglasses. I can't emphasize enough that the quality of all 100 and any more you make later has to be the same as with these 12. Men's lives may depend on this accuracy. Possibly your own lives or your relatives, if we have to fight the Narthani again."
9th hour. The 9th hour bell rang while Josef talked with the glassblowers. After finishing, he walked 100 yards to the foundry. Although no meeting was scheduled, he always felt better seeing cannon barrel production. The Abersford foundry had concentrated on 6-pounders and left 12-pounders to the Kernford foundry, which also cast 6-pounders. He had vacillated in producing heavier cannon,
But now that they'd begun to set up new foundries in Farkash and Bolteki, he had told the Kernford foundry staff to try the 25-pounder barrel again. They were scheduled for the first pour today, and he couldn't resist looking in. However, he was to be disappointed. The intended mold had a defect they'd only just discovered, and they'd put off the casting for at least 3 days. He and the foundry workers discussed the defect and how to avoid it. Then, for another hour, Yosef inspected barrels already cast and visited the carriage mounting shop next door. 4 12-pounders and limbers were lined up outside and covered with canvas to protect them from the weather. When the workers finished casting a fifth, the 5 cannon would form a battery and be taken to Olros City and turned over to the Olros clan for training men as artillerymen. 11th hour. When the 11th hour bell rang, Yosef hesitated outside the large shop being set up to produce muskets, a new enterprise for Keelan province. He had visited the shop the previous day and had gotten into an argument with the foreman, who had decided to make production more efficient and bypassed steps intended to ensure that Keelan muskets be compatible with those made elsewhere on Cadellium. When the foreman had refused to back down, Yosef asked him to step into the next room where they could speak privately. There, Yosef told him, he would be fired from his position immediately if he didn't swear to abide by directions from then on. Unsatisfied with the foreman's response, Yosef had fired him and promoted the next senior worker to foreman, with warnings that he could also be replaced. Now Yosef decided he'd better check on the new foreman. He went inside and found that the old foreman had been hired by his replacement.
"I know he's an irritating bastard," said the new foreman, "but he knows the work and has a family to support."
After a moment of thought, Yosef replied, "All right, but he's your responsibility. If he starts causing problems, I expect you to fire him again."
"Yes, Sir Kolsko, I understand. I don't think there will be a problem."
12th hour. Yosef left the musket factory and glanced up at the sun. Almost noon. He grabbed a satchel tied to Seabiscuit's saddle. He sat under a tree on the edge of the industrial park, took quills, ink, and a sheaf of paper from the satchel, and outlined concrete production. In the afternoon, he would meet with a group of masons. Brickwork and small-scale masonry work with something like aggregate pour concrete was known on Cadellium, though not for large-scale works. Masonry fortifications wouldn't stop a determined Narthani assault. So far, they had seen only 12-pounder cannon with the Narthani army, but they had to be prepared for more powerful cannon and siege mortars. They needed reinforced concrete. Although Yosef couldn't be sure, he estimated 2 feet of reinforced concrete could be breached by heavy cannon firing point-blank for several 6 days or longer, although 3 to 4 feet might be impregnable with current Anyar technology. He sat on a bench next to a tree and wrote, thought, trawled his imperfect memory, and wrote some more. The sun filtered through the leaves, and he leaned against the trunk, his face tilted up to catch flickering light.
"Hey, Yosef, you're asleep?" said a deep voice.
"Huh?" mumbled Yosef. "What?"
"Asleep!
You're supposed to be building cannon during your chemistry magic or whatever it is to save us all from the Narthani. How can you do that by sleeping all day?" Yosef sat upright on the bench as his head cleared. He could only see a large shape next to the sun. He leaned to his right to hide the sun behind the shape that changed into a very large, red-headed and bearded man with a scowling face and amused eyes.
"Carnegie," said Yosef. "I liked you better when you weren't talking so much, and certainly when you
didn't have a sense of humor. I'd tell you to go hide someplace, but there's no place that big. The big man roared, reached down, and grabbed Yosef by his shirt, pulling him to his feet.
Have you eaten anything yet? And where's Shadow, too?
Carnegie was referring to the triumvirate of himself, Balwis Preddy, and Y4 Kales, Yosef's official bodyguards. One was always supposed to be with him. This morning, the duty had fallen to Balwis. The escaped Preddy shadowed Yosef all morning and had last been seen sitting on the ground, his back against a building where they'd tied the horses. Carnegie was due to replace Balwis for the afternoon shift. A puffing Balwis rounded a corner and trotted up to his charge and Carnegie, who scowled for real.
Where were you?
Carnegie growled.
Relieving myself out of sight behind the trees. I was only gone a few minutes, said Balwis, his tone defensive and his face flushed.
Well, piss in your pocket for all I care, snarled Carnegie. You're supposed to never leave Yosef or be out of sight.
Balwis reddened further and looked at Yosef.
Sorry, it won't happen again.
But now that Carnegie is here, I'll be going off.
Without another word, Balwis turned to gather his horse.
He said he was only gone for a moment, said Yosef.
That's what he said, Carnegie grunted. But there's a whorehouse 2 blocks away, and I've seen Balwis coming out a couple of times. I wouldn't be surprised if he thought he could slip away for a quick poke before you woke up and missed him.
Well, shit, said Yosef.
He didn't care whether Balwis availed himself of prostitutes or not. The Cadelli had a relatively blasé attitude about sex. As long as people observed reasonable discretion and took good care of any resulting children. That Balwis might not be trustworthy enough to carry out assignments is what bothered Yosef, in this case, to provide protection. He wondered whether he could trust Balwis to protect Mera, Aeneas, or other members of the Kolsko household.
That's not good, agreed Yosef. I'll have to keep a closer eye on him.
I will too, said Carnegie. I can't say I've ever completely trusted him. Right now, it's time for food. The snarling Greco is only 3 blocks away.
No beer for me this time of day.
Yosef remarked, I have too much to do this afternoon.
That's the trouble with you little people. No capacity, said Carnegie.
He laughed and headed off to the pub, expecting Yosef to catch up on Seabiscuit. 13th hour. Full of barley and beef soup, heavy bread slathered with fresh butter, and a cup of kava, to Carnegie's disapproval, Yosef led Seabiscuit 200 yards to the clan headquarters building on the edge of the central plaza. The largest structure on the western side of the plaza, it faced the Great Hall of the Keelans on the eastern side. St. Tomo's Abbey and associated buildings occupied the entire northern side and several blocks farther north, while tradesmen's shops filled in the southern side. Dennis Vega and Vordic Lewis met him in a meeting room on the second floor. A middle-aged woman Yosef didn't know accompanied them.
Yosef, this is Cullen Lorna, said Dennis. She owns a seamstress shop here in Kernford, and Petter Kenrick advised that we might ask her to think about designing the flags, badges, and medals you suggested.
Yosef remembered some common advice from the military writers he drew on. Clausewitz, Jomini, Sun Tzu, and Napoleon, all four emphasizing the importance of morale. What he knew from his reading, and to be honest, movies and TV, was that men fought harder if they felt they belonged to something bigger, if they felt recognized, if they were emotionally attached to their units and fellows. When the men fought with their own clansmen, there was no problem. But Yosef pushed for the clans to learn to fight in mixed clan units. Without clan identification, Yosef worried that they needed symbols, and he wanted flags for each larger unit. Battle streamers to signify actions they had taken part in, and badges to sew on clothing or medals to pin on. For the next hour and a half, Lorna showed them designs for medals, cloth badges for units and ranks, and flags, all based on Yosef's suggested models. He was especially pleased with the results of the idea he'd given Lorna for the Cadellium flag, something that had never before existed. Each clan had flags and banners, but no single symbol for all of the clans combined. Yosef's proposed flag drew on flags from U.S. history, with stars representing individual clans. Lorna rolled out a green flag with 18 small stars encircling a larger star. The symbolism was for 18 free clans making up Cadellium. He didn't push the concept of 18 clans as part of a greater political union. That concept was too early for the clans to accept. Lewis commented several times in the first few minutes that he thought the entire meeting and idea trivial and not worth their time. In contrast, Dennis participated and joined Yosef in interacting with Lorna. They gave the seamstress enough feedback and suggestions to go back to her shop and come up with a second round of proposals. As a notable exception, Dennis immediately adopted one of the flag examples and declared it the official flag of the 1st Keelan Dragoon Regiment, the largest formal military unit yet formed by the Islanders. The 1,200 men were divided into three Dragoon battalions and an artillery company, with Colonel Dennis Vega the commander. However, organization was not the same as readiness. The battalions and the companies spread over southern Keelan had yet to come together for regimental maneuvers. 14th hour. Yosef heard the ring for the 14th hour. Not that he could have missed it, with St. Thomas bell tower only a few hundred yards away. Through their meeting room's open window, they could see the tower. The bell rang loudly enough that they stopped talking until the reverberations faded. When Yosef left the headquarters, he collected Seabiscuit and Carnegie, and they rode to the new industrial park, where eight masons waited in a planning room with no furniture, save a dozen straight-backed wooden chairs. "Please have a seat, sirs," said Yosef. He proceeded to describe how he wanted them to work on developing concrete, a material composed of crushed rock and mortar.
"We already do this for some projects, Sir Kosko,"
said a graying but solid-looking man.
"But it's known that this concrete, as you call it, tends to crack unless allowed to dry just right, and is not as strong as one might think."
"Have you tried different combinations of materials to look for stronger ones?" asked Yosef.
"Occasionally, but there's little demand for structures made of mortar and rock combinations," said the worker, his manner conveying, "Why are you bothering us with this?"
Yosef sighed to himself. It's not their fault they don't see this as worth pursuing, since there's been no market until now. I need to light a fire under them.
"It comes to me," Yosef said, with a dreamy voice and a pause, as if hearing something, "that the time will come when the safety of Keelan families will depend on fortifications made from what I've described to you as concrete. Therefore, it will be your task to determine the strongest possible concrete. I don't believe it's necessary to ask Hetman Keelan to talk to you about how hard you need to work on this. Is it?"
"No, no, not necessary, Sir Kolsko," the man said hastily. "I'm sure the masons of Kernford will be eager to help. When do you want this concrete?"
"I wouldn't want to rush you, but you should have the details worked out and be ready for the first structure in 1 month," said Yosef. The youngest of the eight masons spoke up.
"If you want it in a month, you're going to have to help us with some of that knowledge you seem to have."
The original man blanched and elbowed his young colleague. Yosef could hear him whisper,
"Sir Kolsko, you idiot."
"Sir Kolsko," came a grudging addition.
Knowledge? Murmured Yosef.
Yes, there should be something I can help you with. He let his voice trail off, as if searching his memory or listening. Concrete. A combination of crushed rock and a special mortar called cement. You make the cement by heating limestone with either shale or clay to produce something we call clinker, which is then ground with gypsum. The heating step has to be quite hot, so you'll need to work on how to get it hot enough, maybe with a coal-fired furnace. The idea for concrete had been percolating in his mind for several months, which gave Yosef time to confirm the availability of the ingredients, though not all could be found close to Kernford. Limestone was abundant throughout Cadellium, as was clay. However, the closest deposits of shale lay 80 miles away in northeast Keelan, and the closest gypsum deposits were in Huel province. He saw no reason to go into the chemical compositions of the ingredients. You will need to have shale and gypsum shipped to Kernford, and you can see Cadwulf Bainham at the Bank of Cadellium building for coin. I'll let him know you'll see him tomorrow. Once you have the cement, mix it with rock crushed to pieces the width of a thumbnail or smaller. Add water, and pour the slurry into a mold you'll make with wood. Don't worry about the mold immediately. When you think you have the ingredient amounts worked out, send me a message, and I'll come look at the progress. Any questions? Yosef asked as guilelessly as he could manage.
The eight men looked at one another worriedly, the youngest just shrugging.
Good. Then I'll let you get to work.
The men filed out of the room, leaving Yosef with Carnegie.
I think you enjoy pretending you're a Septarsh, admonished Carnegie.
Yosef winced.
I didn't think about what I was doing, but I guess you're right. I get frustrated sometimes and tired of trying to convince people to do something I want done. It's easiest if they think it's something they have to do, instead of something they need to be convinced to do.
Oh, I don't blame you getting frustrated, said Carnegie in his gruff voice. But maybe you should save the Septarsh bit for when it's really needed.
What do you think of all the rumors?
I leave such thoughts to those with nothing better to do. It's not worth worrying about whether Yosef the Mysterious is from a land where things are different from here, or if he's communicating with God. It all works out the same, doesn't it?
Maybe in a way, but it's different in how people think of me.
True, admitted Carnegie, though also how you think of yourself. I wonder whether it would make a person forget he can make mistakes if he acts like God talks to him.
I don't have that problem. Not yet, anyway. I know I've hesitated to give advice on things I don't have knowledge of. I'm afraid of making mistakes or having people give too much credence to my opinions. But with the Narthani always on my mind, I find myself more anxious to get things done. I go back and forth between not wanting to have too much influence to feeling impatient when people don't agree with me. It's confusing. While Carnegie didn't respond right away, Yosef could almost see the wheels turning in the red head. Then he smiled.
I was trying to think of a way to help. Certainly nothing about your ideas, but I can keep reminding you that you're Yosef Kolsko, and not Yosef Kolsko the Septarsh. All-knowing, all-wise man, familiar with God.
Which would you be, the angel or the devil on my shoulders?
Carnegie gave Yosef his standard, I don't know what you just said, so why don't you say what you mean, look?
Okay, said Yosef. You're big enough to be both, but stay off my back. I don't want to be crushed. Let's agree
You can always tell me if you think I'm starting to believe in my own infallibility.
That I can do, grunted Carnegie.
15th hour. After leaving the Masons, Yosef and Carnegie rode to the Napalm Project shop, located well away from the other projects, just in case. He had set the project's men to developing napalm and to join forces with a second team that worked on mines. Yosef had gotten a message from Raywin, the Napalm Project foreman, that they were ready to give a demonstration. They met in a field near the building used by the napalm team. Several tables had been set up, with numerous objects of varying sizes and shapes. Raywin led the demonstration. He obviously felt pleased with their results and all but puffed up with enthusiasm. On that partly cloudy day, 50-some men and a few women witnesses had assembled. The development team had set up a triple line of 100 straw men to simulate an Arthani infantry line. Each dummy had paper coverings to allow better scoring of hits. Another 100 yards behind the line stood a block of 225 dummies, 15 to a side. Yosef addressed the witnesses.
One of our problems is how to counter the Narthani infantry tactics and discipline. We want to not only kill Narthani, but break up their major formations and destroy their belief in their invincibility. A group of impressive craftsmen has been working as a team to develop weapons that contribute to those objectives. What you will see is a demonstration of these new weapons. We need to be aware that this is a planned demonstration, and nothing works as easy in real life. Still, it will give you a rough idea of the weapon's capabilities.
He pointed to the line of straw dummies.
You'll see different versions of what we call mines. Two are placed on the ground in front of the straw infantry. On the right side are mines that will explode and throw pieces of lead and metal at the dummies. The line is designed so that the pieces go only in the direction of the dummies and not in this direction. We call these claymore mines. On the left side are containers of an inflammable substance called napalm. The containers are thrown up from the ground and spread burning napalm in all directions. We call these bouncer mines. A similar bouncer mine sends metal and lead in all directions, instead of directional like the claymore. We won't demonstrate this version of the bouncer today. The third weapon involves napalm containers that will be hurled at the straw infantry block farther to the rear. The straw dummies have been soaked with water to more simulate the consistency of human bodies.
Yosef nodded to Raywin.
At your direction, development leader.
Along the 100 yards facing the infantry, 10 men lay on the ground, each one holding a wooden handle with twine wrapped around it. The twine seemed short, ending a few feet in front of each man. Raywin blew into a whistle once. All 10 men pulled hard on the twine. Instead of being short, each length of twine suddenly elongated, as the dirt-covered remainder of the twine popped up from the ground. 4 of 5 napalm and 3 of 5 claymore mines fired on the first pull. The 3 not firing with the first pull were subjected to repeated pulls. 2 more fired on the second pull, and 1 failed to work. On the right, explosions from claymore mines were followed by clouds of straw bursting from the dummies. On the left, fireballs covered almost all of the 50 yards of dummies. Raywin then blew the whistle twice in succession. From the side where the observers had gathered, 6 small catapults, each with an 8-foot throwing lever, fired round objects that trailed a thin line of smoke as they arced toward the more distant block of dummies. One of the objects ignited into a fireball not 20 yards from the catapult, fortunately far enough away to avoid incinerating the catapult's crew. 3 of the objects landed near the square.
to hit the square, ignited, and merged into a fireball covering most of the square, while a third projectile hit the square dead center, didn't ignite, and bounced away. After shocked silence, the crowd erupted in exclamations and a couple of quick prayers. Everyone waited for the team members to check the unexploded mine and napalm projectile to avoid the danger of accidentally eliminating a good part of the Keelan leadership. Then people walked out to see the result. On the right, the infantry lines had been decimated. Of the 50 right-side dummies in the front line, every dummy had at least one hole in its paper covering. More than half of the dummies had simply disintegrated. The degree of damage lessened in the second and third rows, with perhaps two-thirds of the dummies hit in the second row and a third in the last. On the left, all 50 frontline dummies were scorched to some degree, with more than half burned substantially and still smoldering, despite being water-soaked. In the second and third rows, a few dummies had escaped apparent damage, but almost half showed major scorching. In the middle of the line, where some of the fake infantry had suffered the effects of both the claymores and the napalm, the dummies were blackened piles of smoldering straw. They walked farther to the block. Although only two of the thrown napalm containers had hit the square and worked, three-quarters of the dummies were significantly burned and most of the others scorched to some degree. Yosef let observers talk among themselves for another 15 to 20 minutes. Then asked them all to retire to the site meeting room. Remember, this was merely a test where everything had been set up to work. You can imagine what would have happened if the dummies had been real Narthani infantry. The firing line was destroyed. All of the front line would be put out of action and most of the second and third lines impaired. For the infantry block, visualize the effects on the block's fighting ability and the ability of a commander to respond to changing enemy actions. If we are given time to set up these weapons, and enough of them, any Narthani efforts to defeat our positions will be incredibly costly, if not impossible. However, there is one major problem with these weapons. Does anyone see it? Yosef looked around. It was Mulron Lewis, Vordig's son and commander of the Kernford garrison, who saw it first.
It's mainly defensive. The Narthani would have to attack a prearranged position. In addition, it would fix our people in place. If we had to retreat, we'd probably have to abandon the catapults.
You see the problem then, agreed Yosef.
It's only useful in very specific conditions. Not in general field maneuvering, where we couldn't predict either the Narthani positions or their intentions. And one more important consideration. Anyone?
College spoke this time.
Once we use these, the Narthani will know about them and change their tactics.
How long would it take before they started to use the same weapons against us?
Hetman Keelan is correct. The Narthani are professional soldiers and will adjust their actions. Therefore, the best chance we have to inflict the most casualties will be the first time we use these weapons. After that, it will become more difficult to be as effective. As for the Hetman's second point, it's true that once they know about our mines and napalm, it will be only a matter of time before they duplicate them.
Yosef concluded his prepared comments with, "In open field battles, it will be difficult to deploy what you've seen today. However, there is one scenario where we might have advantages over the Narthani, where they attack our prepared defensive positions. The only other time we could probably use most of these weapons is if we put their positions under siege. We also need to carefully decide when to use these weapons so that Narthani don't have time and opportunity to use similar ones on us."
For the remainder of the day, they discussed and argued how to most effectively use these new weapons
asked and got answers to detailed explanations of the mechanisms involved, reviewed the logistics of their production, were cautioned in their deployment, and emphasized the need to train the men in their use. 18th hour. Yosef felt ready to sit in the veranda, take a turn at holding Aeneas, and have a large glass of wine next to him. Unfortunately, Y4 Kales was waiting outside with Carnegie when Yosef exited the clan headquarters building. Shit, thought Yosef, when he saw two of his shadows standing by Seabiscuit, Carnegie's Percheron-like horse, and a roan Yosef recognized as Kales's. I forgot it's the day for sparring practice. After the Baldorian raid of St. Sidran's in Abersford, Dennis had recommended Y4 Kales, the wiry and disreputable Keelan man, when Yosef asked for someone to help him learn to defend himself. He had come to the jarring realization that Anyar was a dangerous place, and like it or not, he needed to know something of fighting, because hoping to never again experience combat might be a fanciful wish. No one seemed to know what Kales had done during the 23 years he'd lived away from Cadellium. But scars and familiarity with blades testified that it wasn't gardening. Over several months, Kales had twice a six-day inflicted bruises on his one and only student. It was only after Yosef managed to stay alive for more than 10 minutes during one of their sparring sessions that Kales admitted Yosef might manage to stay alive until help arrived, should he be unable to avoid a real opponent intent on mayhem. Accepting his fate on this day, Yosef left with Kales and headed back to the Kolsko estate. Carnegie accompanied them, even though he had passed off to Kales the task of evening bodyguard.
It's always amusing to watch the great Yosef Kolsko be humiliated, said Carnegie, oblivious to Yosef's glares.
Back at the estate, the stable master took their horses to be unsaddled and groomed. Kales would spend the night in the cottage shared by Yosef's shadows, while Carnegie headed back to Kernford. Yosef quickly changed into thicker clothing, to better cushion his impact on the ground, and walked to the sparring area set up behind his workout room. Then his resignation about attending the session, and his determination to give Kales a run for his money, took a morale-inhibiting hit. Wooden chairs had been lined up into observing positions. It wasn't the chairs that bothered Yosef, it was the occupants. Mera holding Aeneas, Honorind, Gwenid holding Morwena, Miramel holding Dwina, and Carnegie, a.k.a. the traitor, standing behind the women's chairs. During the next 35 minutes, Yosef refreshed last month's bruises but consoled himself that he'd inflicted a few on Kales. It took all of his willpower to ignore the laughter and jibes from the hostile audience. Yosef was so intense, he missed the silence that followed when he flipped Kales onto his back and his mock knife made a gutting motion. Kales laughed, jumped to his feet, and slapped Yosef on the arm.
Very nice, Yosef. I saw that coming, but you are too fast and too strong.
Let's say we let that be the last fall of the day, Y4, said Yosef. I'd like to end it with a win, even if it does only make it 30 times of me dying to your once. The women walked to the house, followed by the men carrying the chairs back to the veranda. Yosef again missed odd glances thrown back by the women and their whispering as he listened to Kales explain Yosef's mistakes, and Carnegie admit that Yosef might be able to outfight a drunk at the Snarling Greco too, assuming the man was elderly enough. 20th hour. The 19th hour bell had passed while Yosef and Kales sparred, and the rest of the hour slipped by while Yosef bathed, donned fresh clothes, and took half an hour to review the day's mail and messages coming to their home. Precisely at the 20th bell, they sat for the evening meal. Yosef and Mara ate alone several nights a week, but not this evening. While Miramel cared for the two babies, the diners included everyone who was a regular in the house and present that evening, be they family, friends, staff, or bodyguard. Yosef, Mara, Honorind, Gwened, Carnigan, Kales, and Cirrus. As Yosef looked around the table, he thought it an odd collection. The women and two of the most dangerous men on Cadellium. Yet somehow, it didn't seem all that anomalous. 21st hour. The meal finished, Yosef said goodnight and made his nightly visit to Aeneas' crib to kiss the child's soft forehead. Then he walked to his study to deal with more paperwork, filing, writing responses to mail and messages, and making notes. The incoming had been light this day, so he spent a half hour staring at a wall-mounted map of the island. He had marked X's at St. Sidran's and Moreland City, and, as he had many times, wondered where more X's would eventually find themselves on the map. 22nd hour. On the strike of the bell for the 22nd hour, Yosef put away the paper still sitting in front of him on the desk, took a last look at the map, turned off three kerosene lanterns illuminating the room, and walked through the quiet house to their bedroom. Mara met him at the bedroom door. She had just finished bathing Aeneas and left him with Miramel.
I asked Miramel to take care of the feeding tonight. I didn't get much sleep last night and need to get up early tomorrow.
Yosef felt disappointed but understood. He had thought about him and Mara delaying sleep while they engaged in other activities in bed, but there would always be tomorrow night. 23rd hour. Yosef didn't hear the bell for the 23rd hour. He had already been asleep for 40 minutes. His last thought was that he didn't know whether he'd achieved much that day. Thus did the days blend together, with more to do than he could possibly accomplish.